This audio is a recording of the launch of The Lost Revolution, the story of the official IRA and the Workers' Party, a book by Brian Hanley and Scott Miller. It was recorded at the Teachers Club in Dublin on the 10th of September, 2009. It was a packed house with about 250 people in the audience, including many members and ex-members of the Workers' Party. You'll find more audio recordings at the WSM website at www.wsm.ie.
Lucky to have Diarmaid Farrelly here tonight. Diarmaid, as many of you will know, is Chair of Modern History at UCD. He's an extraordinarily diligent researcher who's also got an extraordinary iron will to bring the fruits of his research to public attention. And I think in both of those respects, Brian Hanley and Scott Miller have emulated Diarmaid. Diarmaid's got a new book out as well. It's very big of Diarmaid to be here tonight because his own new book, History of Sex in Ireland, has just been published. And we'll leave it up to the audience tonight to decide which of these books is sexier. Anyway, we're very pleased to have Diarmaid here. Diarmaid Farrelly.
It is indeed a hardback, and unfortunately there are no pictures. Well, there'll be no shortage of offers of pictures from various scoundrels over the years. As Brendan said, it's terrific to see such a huge crowd here, and it's well deserved for Brian and Scott as well. The downside of having such a huge crowd here is that all the money that the generous publisher put behind the bar is now gone. So you'll have to fend for yourselves later on. There's a terrific atmosphere in here at the moment, which I think is a testament to the commitment that so many people have had to trying to change Ireland down through the years, but also to engage with ideas and to engage with political debate as well. It almost feels like we're on a general election footing here tonight. When you hear some of the things that people are talking about. We are living in difficult times, in much the same way that many of the people who figure in Brian and Scott's book were living through difficult times as well. And it might be interesting at some stage to draw some parallels with what is going on. But the most important point to make tonight is that Brian and Scott deserve such high praise. They've managed to untangle the web of the official IRA, of the Workers' Party, from the late 1960s onwards. And they've navigated, I think, a very complex movement, and they brought great skill to bear on that particular task. And when you think of the magnitude and the depth of this particular project, and what's involved in actually bringing a project like this to fruition, I think their achievement becomes all the more remarkable. I've also been told that they're still speaking to each other, which is a remarkable endeavour in itself. Considering the 5 years of work that they put into this book, think of all the people that they talked to, think of all the books that they read, the articles that they read, the primary source documents that they waded through, that they worked their way through. And I suspect there would have been many rows, not just about what was included in this book, but of course about what was left out as well. But what they have achieved is a book which is fascinating to read, which is very fluidly written as well, and which is very, very accessible. They mentioned at the outset of the book that after the IRA's attack on the Brookborough RUC barracks in Fermanagh at the end of 1956, which marked the beginnings of the IRA's border campaign, that a pamphlet was produced shortly afterwards to commemorate that particular event, and it sold 10,000 copies in 1 month. And I hope, and I suspect, that this particular book will emulate that particular achievement, and I think it deserves to do so. 10 years after that particular border campaign, the IRA had a lot of soul-searching to do, and Mick Ryan was set the task of touring the country in order to try and assess the strength as it existed at that stage of the IRA in 1967. And he came back after 2 weeks and said that there is no movement. To which Cathal Goulding replied, "There is a fucking movement." Now, the authors suggest that such frank exchanges at the end of the 1960s were an illustration of what was needed in order to try and revamp the IRA, particularly after the failure of the IRA's border campaign. The idea that there was a need to try and rejuvenate, or a need to try and breathe some life into a fairly despondent IRA and a fairly disorganised IRA as well. And you can see, I suppose, the fruits of those kind of exchanges or that degree of optimism that begins to become apparent in 1968. Tomás Magruder, for example, referred in 1968 to a new generation of Irish men who were going to be fighting a new revolution, and they weren't going to settle for half measures. That was how he put it in 1968. And there's a sense from this book as well that they are thinking internationally, they're not just thinking locally or domestically. Tony Heffernan summed that up in 1968 by articulating this sense of being on the verge of profound change. And it wasn't just an Irish change, it was an international change. This sense of being part of a worldwide movement that could bring about change, that could bring about a very different establishment than existed in the late 1960s. Now, it wasn't long before those hopes were dashed, and before that optimism faded, and before the Republican movement split. And this book is a reminder in some ways for me of the lost opportunities from those years, 1968 and 1969, particularly when you think about the possibilities that might have existed then for a united political movement. What we got instead, of course, was a huge degree of infighting. And there's tremendous sadness in this book. There's tremendous sadness throughout the 1970s at the endemic violence that occurred on this island. There's a terrible sadness about the way in which Republicans turned on each other, about the loss of life that occurred, about the viciousness, I think, of the 1970s and beyond as well. And you do have references at the outset of this book to debate amongst the official IRA about the impossibility of waging a clean war. And it's one of those phrases which makes you stop in your tracks now and you think back and you wonder, was there ever a possibility of waging a clean war? Or was that a phrase that was just used as an excuse to try and excuse some of the more unpalatable things that happened? The idea that the official IRA became involved in what one member termed an unplanned and chaotic war, which they didn't seek to be a part of in the first place. And of course those things were being said, but I wonder how much of those things, or how much of that perspective comes with the benefit of hindsight as well? And is there an attempt to try and excuse some things that were simply inexcusable at the time and now as well? Of course, when people talk about mistakes, they talk about their regret over some of the mistakes that were made. And the Aldershot bombing in February 1972 was one of those mistakes that springs to mind. And there is an interview with one of the official IRA's volunteers about that particular mistake. And that interviewee suggested that you couldn't dwell on those particular mistakes, because if you begin to introduce an element of doubt, well then, where the fuck do you go, as this particular interviewee put it? And in retrospect, of course, the answer is that you go to a place where you are not killing people. But the difficulties, of course, of the early 1970s were really about the way in which the Republicans turned on each other, the Provisional IRA and the Official IRA, both goading each other as well. And there seems to be, from within the Official IRA movement, a pressure being put on themselves about ensuring that they are visible. For some of them, it was about proving to the Brits that the Official IRA still existed. For some, it was about proving to the Provisional IRA that the Official IRA still existed. And perhaps the real shame in the midst of all this is that an awful lot of the intellectual excitement of the late 1960s is lost. And as the authors put it, the policy and the political debate seem to become inaudible amidst the sound of gunfire. Yeah. And certainly that seemed to be the optics of it in the early 1970s as well. What about winning over both Protestant and Catholic working class to form a united political movement, which many had wanted to see and still wanted to see? And what about the Provisional IRA's insistence that it had to banish these dangerous socialists because they wanted to arm themselves to create a free Ireland that was based on Christian principles? The absurdity of all that, in retrospect, is very striking. But, of course, we have to be very careful about imposing these retrospective assessments on the atmosphere, on the climate that existed in the 1970s. And I think the authors have done a great justice to evoking that particular environment and that particular fear and dysfunction, I think, that existed in the 1970s as well. And you can see the culmination of that hatred and that viciousness in October 1975 in particular, where you have the Provisional IRA beginning what's been referred to by some as a pogrom of the official IRA, where you have this series of killings, 11 people dead, 50 maimed over 16 days between October and November 1975, including a 6-year-old Eileen Kelly. So obviously the culmination or certain aspects of that particular feuding led to unimaginable carnage and suffering as well. And I do wonder, where were the debates in all this? How difficult was it to make an intellectual or an ideological case for a socialist republican movement in the midst of all this? I mean, how satisfied were official IRA members with what the authors have referred to as a kind of an esoteric mix of republicanism, Marxism and Christianity? And what exactly did that mix actually mean to the activists on the ground and to those who were involved in the movement? It's probably no wonder that some of them turned to drink when you consider what was going on in what's referred to as their Butlins, the Mornington School in County Louth, where they were learning, or supposed to be learning, about the theory, the theories behind international socialism and Marxism. And some of them seems to be struggling with Des O'Hagan's lectures on dialectical materialism. And again, the authors are very frank about the extent to which the theory that these people, that was supposed to be underpinning these particular actions, was actually being adhered to, or was actually being engaged with in any way. And to what extent were they going to follow through on their promises anyway? Seamus Costello, in the early 1970s, refers to the upcoming referendum on whether Ireland should join the EEC. And he said, quite pointedly, if we lose this particular referendum, well, then we can all pack up as revolutionaries. And to what extent were they actually sincere words in the early 1970s, and what exactly did they reflect? Now, when you consider those particular debates or those particular positions that were being taken, you've got to also be mindful of the infighting that seemed to take precedence over ideological cohesiveness. And I think one of the great achievements of the authors is to try and take us through all those various ideological battles, or all those various attempts to try and revise the message of the official IRA, what became Sinn Féin, the Workers' Party, to try and revise that message all the time, and to try and put it down on paper, the amount of position papers, the amount of documents that were being exchanged. But the problem, of course, was that the infighting did seem to take precedence. There were about 300 members in Dublin, for example, in the middle of the 1970s, and the authors make the point that the disputes between those particular members were conducted in the language of the communist purges of the 1930s. And of course, that increased an awful lot of the difficulties that they were experiencing in any case. Now, there is a new departure, and there are new perspectives being brought to bear, particularly as the movement emerges as Sinn Féin, the Workers' Party, after 1977. And it suggested that they brought a degree of intellectual rigour to the trade unions that was lacking in trade unions prior to that point. And they also began, of course, to develop and articulate a very accurate critique of the establishment as it existed in the Republic. If you consider the response of Eamon Smullen, for example, to Charles J. Hawley's infamous, notorious broadcast, in which he told us that we all had to stop our spending, that we were living beyond our means, that we all had to share in the pain. And Eamon Smullen made the point that Fianna Fáil at that stage was a party run by property speculators in the interests of property speculators, which of course raises the question as to whether there's been any significant change in the main political party over the last 30 years. But alongside that, you had the continuing difficulty of a movement that is struggling to find its position in the north of Ireland. There is an attempt, the authors suggest, to try and prioritise social issues in Northern Ireland in the late 1970s and as you go into the early 1980s as well. But alongside that, you had the continuing activities of Group B, the bank raids that were going on, the insurance scams and so on. And once again, we get from the authors, I think, a very frank overview, not just of the internal dynamism, but also the internal dysfunction of this particular movement. There's an interview there with a former Workers' Party member who's involved in the early 1980s, who makes the point that you could be in the Workers' Party your whole life and still not know about them, or know about the party itself, because democratic centralism is really like a military structure. And this sense of being too far removed from the concerns of their members, and therefore too far removed from the concerns of those who they might want to vote for them, that is something that is recognised, I think, from the early 1980s. And it's extraordinary how many times there was an attempt to change the script. It's extraordinary how many times, in particular, Owen Harris attempted to change the script. And he's one of those individuals who was being looked at by the Republican movement in the late 1960s and the early 1970s as not being your usual imperialist lackey in RTE, as the rest of his colleagues were described. They described Owen Harris at that stage as being the fly in the rather watery soup that is RTE. And of course, Owen Harris remained a fly in the broth of the officials as well, and continually attempted to try and rewrite the script and move them in various different directions. And he's somebody who comes across from these pages and from interviews with other people who are involved as being brilliant in all sorts of ways, being quite mad, being quite menacing at times, and being inspirational for other people, particularly for younger people. Many people found that he provided an inspiration for them to get involved in politics in the first place. And of course, he does these extraordinary somersaults as well. He does seem to be lobbing intellectual hand grenades into the movement all the time. But he did say something in 1987, which seems to be particularly relevant to our concerns today. He suggested that the phrase fiscal rectitude is merely a cover for crimes against humanity. And that really jumped out at the page at me, given what's going on at the moment. I think it should become our new mantra, actually, to try and resist some of the managerial McCarthyism that we're going to be subjected to over the next couple of years. So I suspect Owen Harris might be using that particular phrase in the Senate next week. But such is the evolution of Senator Harris. For the Workers' Party, there was an optimism nonetheless in the 1980s, despite all the huge financial problems, and despite once again the return of mass immigration to Ireland as it afflicted younger people in particular. I still recall, as a Leaving Cert student, I was 1 year off without being able to vote. I recall the election of Frances de Rossa in 1989. He had wooed the women of Dublin with a poster. He was down on Sandymount Strand promising to be a breath of fresh air. People like my mother were greatly taken with this, as were her fellow lefties in the late 1980s. And it does generate a degree of euphoria by the end of the 1980s that they are beginning to carve out a niche and to make their presence felt in a very strong way. Eamon Gilmore, for example, predicted after that election in 1989 that there would be a socialist government before the end of the century. So that'll give you a degree, give you an indication of the degree of optimism. And there was much talk about a new left alliance. And this seems to me to be one of the recurring themes, this idea of we are on the verge of a new departure, of a new left alliance. And of course, it didn't come to that. And it is really striking when you consider the cast of characters in this book. Those who were once radical underdogs, an awful lot of them who are still involved in Irish life, now seem to be very rich and very cautious and very self-satisfied. And that kind of evolution, of course, is by no means unique to Ireland. The radicalism of their youth becomes swallowed by something much different at a later stage. But it does, for me, raise this question once again of whether or not we can look on particular developments over the last few years and even recent elections, such as the election of Joe Higgins, as marking the beginning of a new left alliance. Or is there going to be more infighting in terms of what the left can do or can't do, or whether or not they can agree on a common platform? I think all of these things are particularly relevant to the modern age as well. Another one of the reasons, I suppose, for the failure to make a more long-term breakthrough for the left in this context was the continuance of special activities, that great euphemism that was used for the continuance of bank raids, of in some cases killings and maimings as well. And I think as well the pressure that was brought to bear on these particular individuals as a result of journalists, as a result of those who were determined in the 1980s in particular to try and prevent or expose some of the doublespeak that was going on. And that, of course, is why you have this break. This is why we move on to new agenda, to democratic left, and eventually, ultimately, to merging with the Labour Party. And those journalists were doing their job. And they were doing their jobs, I think, very effectively in the 1980s as well. Now, they're just some of the thoughts that are provoked by this marvellous book. Anyone who's reading this book will have a different response to it. This is my own personal reflections on some of the themes that I've come across. What I'm so impressed with is the extraordinary attention to detail which never becomes overbearing in the narrative. There is a particular skill that is involved in writing a narrative like that and in sustaining a reader's interest over so many different characters. There really is an extraordinary cast of characters in this book, but there's a great energy that's brought to the writing of this book. And it really is a terrific read and a terrific achievement for Brian and Scott to be able to bring the readers with them and to sustain the interest of the readers and to just keep up that degree of vitality and energy throughout the pages. And I think it's very important to observe the tone of the book, because I think they got the tone right, and the tone of the book is an important part of it. It's cool, it's dispassionate, it's detached, and it's devoid of sermonising. It's a pity I can't be the same. But they do strike, I think, the right tone. They do manage to distance themselves to the degree that they can write about this with great authority, and that they can write about it in quite a detached and quite a dispassionate way, which is very important for us to now be able to appreciate the significance of what went on in Ireland, particularly in the 1970s and the 1980s. And this is a book that will not just appeal to those who are players, or those who are contemporaries, or those who are just interested in a good read about Irish politics. It's also a hugely important contribution to our knowledge of politics, socialism and society in modern Irish history. And I want to warmly congratulate both Brian and Scott. Thank you.
First of all, for his very, very generous comments. I also want to thank Brendan Barrington and indeed everybody at Penguin Ireland for their support for the last few years. I'm sure the editing process over the last 6 months was as enjoyable for Brendan as it was for us. I also want to thank Charlie Byrne, who's come up from Galway to do the books tonight. And if you're in the City of the Tribes, I recommend a visit to Charlie's bookshop down there. More importantly, I want to particularly thank those who assisted the book in terms of interviews, contacts, documents, photographs, and in various other ways. It would not have been possible without the assistance of all these people. And we've thanked very many of them in the book. There's also some people who rather we didn't mention in print, but sincerely, this book is your book. It would not have been possible without you. And it was humbling to be welcomed into people's homes, people who we'd never met before, who knew nothing about us, but were prepared to talk about their pasts, to talk about the movement they were involved in, some of which they were proud of, some that they may have regretted certain instances of, to share documents with us, to share personal papers, to share memories, and to two people who they didn't know, who could have been anybody, but they were happy to talk to us in the belief that we would try and do justice to their story. And I hope we have done some sort of justice to their story. And I again thank all those people. Many of them are here tonight. I thank my family in the book, and it goes without saying how important they are to me. And especially my wife Orla, who lived with this project for the last 5 years. But during that 5 years, Orla noted on several occasions that there seemed to be three of us in this particular marriage. Me, her, and Scott, obviously. And I want to thank Scott Miller. It was Scott who, in 2004, suggested to me that a book on the officials and the Workers' Party was long overdue. And I'd known Scott for maybe 10 or 15 years, but I kind of lost contact with him. Every time I met him, I always thought he must be very accident-prone, because he always seemed to have his arm in a sling or have a book around. Could never figure out what was wrong with him. In 2004, he asked me to get involved in this project. And initially, I just didn't think it was possible. I thought there might be a lot of interesting stuff in the various newspapers in the National Library, maybe something in the National Archives, but I didn't think that the people who were involved in the movement over the years since the 50s would open up to two researchers. I honestly thought the project would be stillborn. It was Scott's determination to tell that story that was very often what drove it at particular moments when I often thought that really we should give it up because we were never going to get it finished. And Orla will tell you there are numerous occasions when I thought that this story was never going to be told. And without Scott's enthusiasm, I have to say there would be no book. So I want to thank Scott for that. think it also would be fair to say that it wasn't exactly an easygoing relationship. Those of a certain age will know who Felix and Oscar were, and I'm not going to say which one of us were part of that partnership. From almost coming to blows at tube stations in London after cars were clamped at Westminster and taken away, you can ask us afterwards. From weeks to refusing to talk to each other over rows about what exactly the editorial in the United Irishman meant in August 1974. We came at several stages close to splitting ourselves over the story. And a number of people have pointed out already that, you know, maybe the story is there, but it's not very analytical. There's not a lot of analysis. How could Meath and Scott have agreed on anything for that long to come up with a definitive analysis of the official Republican movement? But what I hope it is, and there was a review very quickly after the book came out on a website called Dublin Opinion by a guy called Conor McCabe. I don't know if there'd be a better review. It was a very interesting review. And he talked about it being history from below. Now, I'm not sure if it is, but I hope we've managed to try and tell the story of the officials and the Workers' Party in a way that doesn't sneer at the people who participated, in a way that doesn't sneer with anybody who took various sides in the splits and feuds that developed. There's a real tendency, when we came across this the other day, perhaps in an interview with a broadcaster, to adopt the Michael O'Learyisation of language when you talk about the Irish left. That's all about headbangers and nutters and idiots who really thought, did they really think there could be socialism in this country? I hope nobody comes away from our book thinking that these people are mad. These were people who, for all their faults and all their weaknesses, and I would disagree with very many of the decisions they made, did attempt to change Irish society for the better from the 1950s onwards. And I hope that comes out of the book as well, and I hope you enjoy it. Thanks very much.
My contribution very short. I haven't done any public speaking since the UCD student union election of 1998. Some people here are the same people in that audience, by the way. Thank you all very much for coming along. It's a great turnout. We didn't expect nearly the amount of people that have come along here to show their appreciation this evening. Thanks very much for Brian putting up with us over the last 5 years. Thank you all for also putting up with us over the last 5 years. I know it's been difficult, and thanks to my family, some of them have come from Spain over here to be here to read the book, hopefully at some stage, and thanks to my mother and my father as well. When myself and Brian began this 18-month project 5 years ago, we had no idea of the great number of new friends we would meet along the way. I want to thank all those who let us into their memories to recount the sometimes painful, sometimes sad, sometimes funny tales of the official Republican movement. Thank you all. You know who you are there. It's good to see here tonight members of various left-wing political groups, my family, my friends. my family, my friends, fellow journalists, thank you very much. And others of no political persuasion. Fionnuala Murphy, I don't know, is he here yet? Somewhere. Although I don't want to start thanking people individually, there's a few people I see in the audience here that do have to be pointed out to people. There's Roy Johnson. Some people say he was the cause of all this. In the book we see he was only partly the cause. There's Mick Ryan there, a man whose bravery stands out in this book and who is just integral to the whole history of the official Republican movement. And we have me and Tomás McGillah. We are. It's a real honour to have them here. Both of them, their whole lives are tied into the history of the Republican movement, and particularly our former Lord Mayor. It's a real honour. Thanks, Tomás. This story is a whole part of the process of progressive politics, looking anew at its past and working towards unity rather than division. The Lost Revolution was written as a narrative, not as a critique. Who am I or Brian to judge people such as Billy McMillan, Malachy McGurran, even Rory O'Brodick, and indeed Jock Hockey? We are not in a position to judge these people, we can only tell the story. I'm not in a position to judge, but in the case of one man whose life provided the steel spine, not only of this book, but of the official movement, I feel that I had no enough to form an opinion. Sean Garland, at the age of 75 years, lives under fear of extradition to the United States of America. In the last days of the discredited regime of George Bush, a warrant demanding he be legally dragged from his homeland to the US and face very dubious charges was filed. Sean could not be here tonight, partly because of this threat. What happened during the Cold War period is covered in this book. What Sean Garland is now entangled in, according to the US authorities, is either entrapment or, at the worst, a web of deceit. People should never blindly commit to a cause. I'd call upon people to read this book, which covers events, warts and all. And after they've seen that, then they can consider supporting the campaign to allow a man who, rightly or wrongly, was committed to a moral code to live out his old age in peace in his own land. Thank you very much.
This audio is a recording of the launch of The Lost Revolution, the story of the official IRA and the Workers' Party, a book by Brian Hanley and Scott Miller. It was recorded at the Teachers Club in Dublin on the 10th of September, 2009. It was a packed house with about 250 people in the audience, including many members and ex-members of the Workers' Party. You'll find more audio recordings at the WSM website at www.wsm.ie.